From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the state's highest court ruled that local law enforcement cannot detain immigrants based on requests from the federal government. The governor thinks the state should be allowed to cooperate in cases dealing with violent criminals.
I think those people are folks that we should be able to discuss with the feds and hold for some period of time so that the feds have an opportunity to determine if they should be sent back to their home country.
We'll dig into the court's ruling and more in our Week in Review. Also today, astronaut Sunita Williams. She commanded the International Space Station, and now she's supporting a new generation of astronauts looking to Mars.
My time here as an astronaut and my ability to have gone to space two times has helped taken some baby steps to take that next generation of space explorers even further.
All that and Massachusetts' high cost of housing just got even higher. Coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Week in Review time, and we're going to start with the major decision on immigration that came this week from the state's highest court. The SJC ruled that local law enforcement cannot comply with federal detention requests, asking them to hold immigrants after criminal proceedings end. Here's Massachusetts Attorney General and her reaction.
What this really does is reflect a complete rejection of what we've seen from the Trump administration in terms of its policies and practices, which fundamentally have been about stoking fear in our immigrant communities and doing things that actually undermine public safety.
Again, that's Maura Healey, the Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The United States Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, on the other hand, says it's the detainers that are essential for public safety. Emma Winger, one of the defense attorneys in the Supreme Judicial Court case, she disagrees.
Detainers only apply to folks who have, for example, been found not guilty, or their case has been dismissed, or a judge has determined that they should be released on bail. So this case doesn't in any way threaten, you know, the public safety of Massachusetts residents.
However, Governor Charlie Baker seems to disagree with that. He says he wants a new law that would allow some immigrant detentions.
We'll file legislation probably next week that gives us the ability, that would give us, if it were passed here in Massachusetts, would give us the ability to hold violent, dangerous criminals for some period of time, a short period of time, if the feds in fact believe they have an immigration status issue.
All right, so a lot to discuss just on this issue, and there's even more news this week, which we will get to. So helping us to sort through all of it is Tiziana Deering, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College. She's also a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Tiziana, it's great to see you.
Thanks, good to be here.
Also with us today is Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, it is great to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Okay, well, Tiziana, let me just start with you. I mean, I believe this is the first time that a state's highest court has made a ruling on ICE detention requests, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, I should say. Just your reaction to the fact that SJC found them to be equivalent to unlawful arrests.
Yeah, I guess I think that if you care at all about civil liberties, it's hard not to celebrate this ruling and be concerned about efforts to curb the ruling. You know, at the end of the day, I know Jeff Sessions argues this makes us safer. There are all kinds of things we can do that arguably make us safer, but we don't do them because we're not willing to trade liberty for that level of safety. And being able to hold people because you want to do homework on them is a really scary thought for a government to be able to impose on its people.
Now, Michael, I mean, here was a case in which the SJC looked to Massachusetts state law, obviously, as they have to make their decision. And they found that there was no law that explicitly allowed local law enforcement or court officers to, you know, do these detentions again for up to 48 hours. And I should say clearly, after criminal proceedings have come to an end, which is a major part of this. So, I mean, do you think that we just heard Governor Baker say he may seek to amend the law to allow some detentions? Your response to that?
Well, I think what's going to happen now is it really is going to bring this whole issue to the fore, you know, in state government on Beacon Hill in a way that we haven't seen in some time. And so, you know, the word that was being used was that the ruling was clarifying. It cleared up sort of the ambiguity. But now we're hearing from both some of the more liberal members of the legislature, their desire to go in and try to sort of codify this through statute, but we've also had one of the leading Republicans in the legislature say that he's eager to get in there as well. And it seems like the governor, as is true to form, is going to try to sort of thread the needle or sort of stand somewhere in the middle, I think, on this.
So let me ask you more about Governor Baker here, because obviously on this issue, as with many that have been championed by President Trump, Governor Baker has kind of had to play this cat and mouse game. And I feel like it's happening all over again because in that tape that we heard, he's looking to file legislation that has to deal with, you know, in his words, specifically violent criminals. But on the other hand, he's facing re-election here. I can only imagine that Democratic gubernatorial hopefuls are going to ignore that subtlety and just say, look, he's trying to overturn what the SJC has done on immigration.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, this is kind of they're going to try to make this one of these which side are you on kind of debates and take away sort of the nuance that Governor Baker loves to sort of get in the middle of and sort of things are always very complicated is kind of his response to these issues. But I think you're right that it's going to kind of call the question as to how we're really going to approach these issues, especially with the feds pushing so hard from one side.
Tiziana, before I turn back to you, let's hear again from the governor himself. He was speaking to reporters yesterday about what he would like to see the legislature do after the ruling had come down from the SJC. And again, he wants to have a law to allow some degree of cooperation with immigration and customs enforcement.
We believe that holding people and engaging with the federal government for people who have committed violent crimes, who've been convicted of violent crimes, murder, rape, drug trafficking, human trafficking, terrorism, those people, we believe, we should be able to engage the feds with, and if they are, in fact, here illegally, be able to hold them for some period of time, 24 hours, to give the feds the ability to pick them up.
Tiziana, your thoughts?
You know, with all due respect to the governor, and I really do respect him, we do have that ability. It's incarceration, which is part of the punishment for having committed the crime. What's at play here is the fact that we're supposed to be detaining people once that is over. And I don't think we're entitled to do that. And I would be surprised, although I am not a legal scholar, I would be surprised if we're going to have a piece of legislation that's going to face legal challenge and survive it if the argument is you've done your time, you're supposed to be free, but because of a crime for which you've already paid, we're going to hold you and do research on you to see if we can kick you out of the country.
Well, I mean, we did speak to a legal scholar about this, former federal judge Nancy Gertner, and she said one of the key things to remember here is that immigration violations are largely considered to be civil violations, right? And here ICE had been asking local law enforcement to make those detentions when, again, in the Massachusetts statutes, there's nothing that says that they can or should be allowed to make those civil detentions. Now, those are pretty well-defined areas, criminal versus civil. I don't know how you can thread the needle there with a new statute, but, I mean, Michael, perhaps I'm wrong. Anything's possible when politicians are motivated enough.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think I don't really have a read on how this will play out politically. I mean, I think that this does sound, if you heard that sound bite from the governor, I mean, that was kind of the harsher Charlie Baker. I mean, I almost felt like I heard a little echo in that of Trump's talk about the bad hombres. You know, he was really trying to characterize a set of immigrants that he feels. I'm sure he thinks it's the right thing, but you also feel like the political wheels are turning, and he thinks if you paint it in this way, there's going to be political support for the idea of, you know, what's the harm of holding these people who've committed, you know, serious crimes for which, as Tiziana says, they've paid the price already. But I think people don't always approach these with a highly legalistic or, you know, with a Bill of Rights in front of them sort of mentality. And that's what it seems like he's appealing to.
And yeah. Yet this is exactly the moment when you do need to approach these things with a Bill of Rights mentality. I mean, it's a short trip in any of these cases. And you know, this is always the way one should think about this is, do I want this applied to me? Is there a moment when my government decides I'm the dangerous one? Mm. And if so, would I find this acceptable applied to me? My answer in this case is heck no, absolutely not. So, you know, I think this is a time when you want to approach it with the Bill of Rights in front of you.
And I have to say, I mean, I don't know if any legal scholars that happen to be listening on this fine Friday afternoon. Send me a tweet at Radio Boston, because, you know, if the ultimate goal for violent criminals is deportation, can that not be part of the criminal conviction or the sentence that they're given? So I don't know. Legal scholars out there, send us a tweet at Radio Boston and let me know. And while I wait for you to educate us, let's move on to healthcare if we can, because obviously a whole heck of a lot happened in the past 24 hours, or I should say even just in the wee hours of this morning. I was one of those people who was lying in my bed in the dark with my phone, my little phone, like casting a pale blue light on my face as I was watching through Twitter.
I thought that pale blue light was on Mitch McConnell's face.
Well, exactly.
At a certain point.
At a certain point. And it would be at this point when 49-51, the so-called skinny repeal bill failed because three Republican senators cast no votes. Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. And here's the third vote from Arizona Senator John McCain. No. So what that was Senator McCain saying no and several people gasping, probably from the gallery because folks were watching. Now, again, it took those three Republican no votes to put a spike through the so-called skinny repeal. Michael, your thoughts on that?
Well, I thought it was an astounding moment of drama on the Senate floor, which we rarely have. And I thought it also, McCain seemed to be, frankly, reveling in this. And he's always played this kind of maverick role. He's had moments when he's veered away from that, and he's looked much more like a sort of toe-the-line Republican. But this was the mavericky McCain come back. I mean, the irony, I thought, was that his maverickiness, if you can call it that, was really him sort of calling for a return to a more sober, very sort of small-c conservative way of operating, which is the deliberative process. You know, he was really talking a lot about the kind of traditions of the Senate. I mean, that's not really mavericky. He was kind of – it's the Senate Republicans who he said have gone mavericky right. And gone off the rails with how they've been handling this.
Okay, so I have a lot to say about this. I'm going to try and control myself here.
This has nothing
to do with my genuine deep respect for Senator McCain's service to this country. I mean, without a doubt. But, you know, earlier this week when he gave that impassioned speech about, you know, the deliberative process right. of the Senate, I just thought, your words, Senator McCain, ring mighty hollow to these ears because he had just voted to advance debate. I mean, on bills that nobody even knew what the content of those bills were.
Right.
So I did not understand, like, how it could be mavericky on one hand, but on the other hand, absolutely advancing the agenda that he was saying that was in opposition to the traditions of the august body of the Senate.
Yeah. So, A, the mavericks here were Murkowski and Collins, not McCain.
From the start.
By the way, BTW, yeah. Right? And B, this stopped being about health care at a minimum a week ago. This was about the Better Self-Preservation Act of the Republican Party, not about health care in any way. And that was a moment of self-preservation, as everything this week has been about. The minute we exited a realm where anything that got passed was actually anything anyone wanted passed, but some giant procedural exercise to deliver on a campaign promise, we entered a world of sort of naked cynicism that is so stunning as to just kind of leave you wondering what's going to happen next.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's been a lot of discussion and there should be more discussion on the ways that Obamacare can be improved, right? But I can't, it's difficult for me to get past this notion that the Republican Party, Republican leadership, had 7 years, right? And this was a top-level priority for them. And yet, when it came down to it, Senator Mitch McConnell releases a bill with, what, 2 hours before a vote? And then...
Well, there was one they said they were going to write during their lunch break yesterday or something. I mean, this was astounding. They're going to, you know, they're going to sort of fix 20% of the U.S. economy, you know, over sandwiches.
Right, I'll have what they're having. If they're able to do that over lunch, I want to eat that food.
And then accuses Democrats of not being cooperative or of not being willing to engage with the content of the bill. I mean, it defies me, but it defies my belief, honestly. But it happened. I mean, this is the world we're living in. But, Tiziana, to get to a point that you were making, and I would love to hear from both of you on this, let's talk a little bit more about Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, because everyone's focusing on John McCain, but really it was those two female senators from the start who said they had principled reasons to vote against the packages that were put before them, and they stuck with them despite getting bizarre threats like who was it that that challenged Senator Collins virtually to a duel?
Basically,
Aaron
like
Burr
to take
style?
You outside to shoot you.
Is that the congressman from Texas?
Yes,
I think?
And he said he was joking. But on the other hand, and then of course the Trump administration hinting that Alaska as a state could suffer some consequences via federal programs because of Murkowski's
vote. Maybe he'd sell it back to the Russians or something.
So let's just put this in context. Can you imagine a circumstance where I am in my workplace? I disagree with my male colleagues and somebody, quote unquote, jokes that they're going to take me outside and shoot me. I mean, it would be beyond the pale. It would be breathtaking to think that that would happen in a workplace, let alone have my future threatened, the future of the people I represent threatened, et cetera. Now, I'm not going to get all hyperventilate-y about this because these are tough women and they can handle it.
You can leave that to me.
There's clearly, A, a gender dimension to what's going on here. But B, you know, we are all hungering for moments of leadership where people stick to their principles. And I think it's worth taking a moment to pause and appreciate that these women were strong and decisive and stuck with their principles. Whether you agree with those principles or not, This is a good moment for gratitude for people who were clear about what they believed in and stuck to it in the face of ridiculous levels of personal adversity from their colleagues.
Michael, your thoughts?
No, I agree. And I think you can kind of go down the list of some of their male colleagues who didn't stick with their principles. I mean, there was a much longer list of Republicans, Dean Heller from Nevada, Portman of Ohio. I mean, there were other people who seemed equally concerned about seeing millions of people thrown off health care coverage who ended up falling in line in the end. So,
yeah.
So I mean, their courageousness stands out all the more, I think.
So President Trump, of course, afterwards tweeted, okay, well, let Obamacare fail now, as he claims to have said from the beginning, which he has not. I mean, is that the path forward now? I mean, in terms of, do you think that the Republican Party, Mitch McConnell, whomever, is going to try and advance any new bill on health care, or they're done with it for now?
I mean, I don't think that they are going to try to on their own. I mean, the most optimistic scenario is that they actually return to some deliberative process, that they try to sort of have a bipartisan approach that includes, the moderate Republicans and tries to get at what everyone agrees could be some improvements to the law. So, you know, we'll have to see. That's sort of, you know, you have to sort of believe in maybe unicorns and other things in this current Congress to think that could happen. But that's at least, you know, as of a few hours ago, the direction people are talking about.
Yeah. Tiziana?
Yeah, I do think it's fair to note that this unipartisan approach predates this Congress and the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
The ACA and the way it was passed in the first place set the precedent for this sort of 51%, we're going to go it alone, do it with our own party. So our inability to do a bipartisan health care bill goes back further than 7 years.
Right.
And I think that creates a real challenge. What one, I think, has to hope as an American, must hope, is that at the end of the day, people decide, well, actually, we have a healthcare system that we need to fix so that people will be healthier and we can solve this problem. And all the grandstanding didn't work.
Yeah.
All of this unipartisan approach just didn't work. And sooner or later, people are going to have to belly up to the table and actually fix this.
Right, right.
And hopefully now we can get there.
I mean, I take your point about the party line nature of so many votes here on these major, major issues. But at least in the deliberative process part, the ACA, of course, Obamacare was very, very different than these recent health care bills we've seen.
Yeah.
All right. So more Washington news, but let's touch on another big story that came out of the Trump administration this week. We want to note that this past Wednesday, July 26, marked the 69th anniversary of President Harry Truman's signing of Executive Order 9981. Now, that was the order that desegregated the United States military, again, 69 years ago. That same day, you know, this in 2017, just this past Wednesday, President Donald Trump sent out a tweet that announced that, quote, the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the United States military, essentially announcing, to the surprise of many, including some folks in the Pentagon, a ban on transgender Americans from serving in the military. So here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders describing how the president reached his conclusion and his announcement on Wednesday.
He's also voiced that this is a very expensive and disruptive policy, and based on consultation that he's had with his national security team, came to the conclusion that it erodes military readiness and unit cohesion.
So the expense part Sarah Huckabee Sanders was referring to was the estimated medical costs for transgender members of the military. But of course, that is, according to several studies, one coming out of the Rand Corporation, those medical costs are 0.004% of the Defense Department's annual health care spending. So, Michael Jonas, first of all, what do you take about executive order policy made by tweet?
Well, I mean, the process is, of course, absurd to do it that way. But on the substance also, I think it sort of reminds you of, you know, well, with this administration, it's like the Lily Tomlin line, no matter how cynical I am, it's hard to keep up. I mean, this sort of seemed to take the cake in terms of a policy pronouncement that, you know, really didn't have the consultation of defense forces. The defense secretary was taken by surprise by it. And I don't think anyone thinks this was really driven by a serious review of what was going on. Again, I think it was just one of the most cynical moves that the president has made so far in his 6 months.
There was reporting that perhaps earlier this week, Steve Bannon, again, this is just reported, but that Steve Bannon had brought Ann Coulter into the White House and that Coulter appealed to Trump and said, you have to turn back to your base. You have to appeal to your base. One wonders if you know, this is part of that.
Right, or some people have said, is it a makeup call for the way he's treated Jeff Sessions? I mean, this is, you know, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, kindergarten, you know, dynamics going on here with, you know, you called him a name, but make up, you know, for it, you know, with this other move.
Tiziana?
Oh, my God. Right? I mean, there are so many things.
We're at that level.
Yeah. There are so many things I want to say about this that I don't even know where to start. But one thing that I would say, you know, if you're a doctor, right, you have a medical license. And if you malpractice as a doctor, you can lose your license. If you're a lawyer and you're guilty of malpractice as a lawyer, you can be disbarred. We don't have a licensure for executive leadership. And so when somebody is guilty of pure malpractice of leadership, there's no way to say that's it, you lose your license, you don't get to be an executive leader anymore. This is malpractice of leadership at every level that one can examine it. It is just a complete abandonment of the basic principles of effective leadership.
Other people see it as the strength of a commander-in-chief who knows his own mind and is making decisions that he believes are in the best interest of the readiness of the United States military.
Yeah, and that's people who haven't led. Because there's decisiveness, and then there's implementation, and then there's destabilizing and undermining the people that work for you and the ability to be effective in your mission. So you go ahead and be as all decisively as you want to be, right, as an executive leader. But you don't destabilize 2,000 to 6,000 of the people who work for you instantly because you can't have the patience to implement it in a way that allows your people to do what they need to do. This is separate from the stupidity of the decision.
So,
the
good point.
The execution of it is a problem.
You got to wonder how General Mattis is feeling, right? I mean, he's on vacation this week, but he just last month had put out a memorandum or announcement saying that the DOD is going through a deliberative process on its decision whether or not to continue the Obama administration's decision to allow transgender members of the military to serve openly. And he said they were going to come to a conclusion via their process by December. And here we are, just that, like, that just got, the rug just got pulled out from under him.
And Trump does that over and over. I mean, he undercuts all of the people under him. And I think to Sianna's point, I mean, he's not an executive leader. He hasn't really, I mean, the company he led was kind of a little family enterprise that kind of got very large. But, you know, he's never been subjected to any of the kind of rigor and expectations and accountability that leaders really are held to.
And let's just suppose for a moment that this decision stands. The Pentagon doesn't even know how it's going to be implemented. I mean, there's whether or not you agree with the decision, like you said, Tiziana, there are so many the ripple effects are immense.
Yes. Yes, they are. And not well thought out. And again, you know, let's go back to the Ann Coulter moment, right? So Ann Coulter comes in and says, you got to turn to your base. How about you don't do that with the national security of the United States, right? How about you have some sense of proportionality and are able to understand the portfolio of things for which you are responsible and make smart and reasonable trade-offs across that portfolio, let alone the fact that, frankly, we just can't afford to be cutting people out who want to serve the United States and are healthy, well, and prepared to do that. Yeah. That's a whole other discussion we could also have.
Okay. So since it is Friday and it's a beautiful day, let's turn away from the complex politics coming out of Washington and end with our hubbubs. And those are the stories that, you know, maybe might put us in a little bit of a better mood, I'm thinking.
Not mine.
No. It's supposed to be the
Debbie Downer, right?
I am today. I am totally Debbie Downer.
Okay, well,
today.
I guess we should start with you.
No, not,
okay, no. Okay, Michael, what's your hubbub?
All right, well, mine is definitely lighter, on the lighter side, and that is that the building that everyone loves to hate in Boston City Hall, has undergone a bit of a makeover. And the lobby, at least where you walk in off the main plaza, now has a welcome desk with a friendly person there. They've got a nice coffee bar there. There's seating, and there's a self-service big screen kiosk where you can sort of find your way through that hulking maze. And
Still surrounded by concrete, though.
You are surrounded by concrete. It's a funny move. You know, you've got to say for Mayor Marty Walsh, who campaigned on the idea that we're just going to tear this thing down and build a new city hall. But I think they've shown that through some small moves, you can make this fortress a little more friendly. Now, on the other hand, you're probably there because you're angry about a $100 parking ticket that you want to go contest because the sign was obscured and it's not fair. But at least you know.
But you can get a nice coffee in the lobby now,
and
though.
And there's
going
to be a friendly face steering you to where you write your check.
Any improvement, big or small, is most welcome when it comes to City Hall. Tiziana Dearing, come on.
All right. So I was going to bring you in the skinny repeal diet if it had passed last night, but I didn't because it didn't. I'm curious what all the bajillion genetic researchers in Boston think today, because it came out this week that a researcher in Oregon and his team actually edited the DNA of a viable human embryo this week. And regardless of how you feel about that, it strikes me that this is one of those moments when something incredibly important just happened and got a sidebar mention on page 82 of whatever publication it was, and yet a few years from now could be one of the most fundamental things going on in our lives. I mean, this is the beginning of affecting human evolution.
Wow.
And it happened in Oregon.
I grew up in Oregon. What do you say?
It happened in Oregon? Bad. No, meaning it happened in Oregon, like we're all focused on what's happening in Washington.
Oh.
And out in Oregon, this huge thing.
I see. A reminder that there's an entire rest of the country that we should be paying attention
right.
to. Okay.
And some serious stuff's going down on it.
Yeah, that's absolutely. Right. Okay, so mine... continuing my great tradition of doing either science or animal hubbubs, I'm back into the animal realm of things. This is coming from my fantastic producer, Kathleen McNerney, who is an avid reader of Governing Magazine. That's how we roll here at Radio Boston.
And who knew there was one?
Governing Magazine has reported a list of the rattiest cities in America in terms
as
in rat sightings. And sadly, or maybe not sadly, thankfully, Boston is not number one. Boston is number two.
Oh,
however, just behind Philly. Now, 18% of Philadelphia area households reported rodent sightings or rat sightings, the highest share of the 25 metro areas they looked at. Boston is number two at 16.9%, coming in at a strong number three, New York City. So I suppose we beat New York, at least in this way, which... we'll be proud of it regardless. Okay, so we are a ratty city, everybody. Tiziana Dearing, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. It was great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Meteor shower incoming.
We have a meteor shower.
Capcom, come in.
Guys, just stay calm. We believe the orbiter has survived the meteor shower.
I believe we have a leak.
Okay, pressure's going down. This is bad.
Man is seizing. What do we do?
Get them out of here.
No!
Stop, my God! Throw them in the FEMA hallway.
Moderate cabin pressure onboard the station.
Well, thankfully, no one is actually dead, because that was a team of teenagers simulating a landing on the surface of Mars, dealing in real time with everything that could go wrong in a manned Mars mission. That scene is from the film The Mars Generation, a documentary about a class of teenagers at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama, a.k.a. Space Camp, who are imagining and training for going to Mars someday. Now, one person with a very unique view on this is Sunita Williams. She has served as the commander of the International Space Station. She spent a total of 322 days in space and has logged 50 hours, 40 minutes doing spacewalks. She's featured in the Mars Generation film, which is playing this Sunday at the Woods Hole Film Festival, and she joins us now. Sunita Williams, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Magna. It's really good to be here with you.
I am almost uncontrollably excited to talk to you, so it is great to have you. So tell me, first of all, what do you make of the film The Mars Generation, and how optimistic are you that someday, rather soon, we will be sending a manned mission to Mars?
Well, that opening scene is a little scary, and that would be a really bad day. But yeah. Aside for that part, the rest of the film, I got a chance to take a look at it, is really pretty cool. You know, we're here, and it's going to be here in Woods Hole at the film festival, in a really great place where there's a lot of science in this area. So it's cool to think and talk about it. And I think it's going to happen before long. You know, we're on that path with the Commercial Crew program and then the Orion SLS program for NASA. And so we're getting there. And I think it's almost a reality, or going to be a reality. It's touchable reality for the kids who are in high school and younger. So I'm excited for them, and hopefully we'll have made a good path for them to get there.
Yeah, I mean, and NASA has been given a challenge to send humans to Mars by 2030, or at least in the 2030s. So that's actually not that far away. You talk to a lot of young people who have their sights set on the cosmos. And I presume that you tell them your own story. I mean, how is it that you became an astronaut? And was it always something you dreamed of?
Oh, for me, no. It was a little bit of a slightly happenstance and a lot of good luck. And just, you know, I think a little perseverance. You know, I wanted to be a veterinarian.
Really?
Yeah, I really wanted to be a veterinarian and go to school in this wonderful city. Didn't quite work out that way, and ended up joining the Navy as a suggestion of my big brother, which was really awesome, actually. And I didn't realize it at the time, but provided a lot of leadership and followership, teamwork opportunities, and led me down the path to be a helicopter pilot and a test pilot. And that sort of was the shoe in the door to making me understand that, hey, things are possible. And I got down to NASA at Johnson Space Center and realized I could do the things that those guys are doing, like anybody can if they have that opportunity and take it.
Yeah, and let me just say, you probably could do them and have done them better, because there are very few people on planet Earth who can say they've commanded a mission on the International Space Station.
Yeah, I'm pretty lucky. That was very, very awesome. A huge responsibility, but you know, I think just like in the movie The Martian, you take one step at a time. You don't look at the big problem all together, because I think it's a little intimidating. So you just take it one day at a time. You know, meet the people that are going to work with you, for you, and you're going to work for, and really try to do the best job that you can. And I think that's all teamwork, and that's what space travel's about.
Yeah, I mean, and you have so much experience on these missions. 322 days in space, more than 50 hours on spacewalks. I mean, let me just ask you about that. What is it like being up there?
A little scary at times when it's only your visor between you and the outside, you know, not so nice area of space where there's no air to breathe, the vacuum that's really hot, really cold. So that's scary, but you take it, like, again, one step at a time. You know, you have a lot of things to do when you're out on a spacewalk, and that sort of overwhelms your mind. Like, I got to get this test done and this test done, but you can't help every now and then stopping and looking where you are and watching the world whiz by you and just go, whoa. But okay, never mind, just keep working. You know, it's an incredible view, incredible place to work, and that's the culmination of a huge team of people making it happen for the astronauts who are out there doing the job.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the fact that you said that it is a little scary, because, I mean, you are there out there in the vacuum and the blackness of space. But like you said, you have this great team. And I was wondering if you could tell us this story, because I was reading about how on a spacewalk, an 8-hour spacewalk you had to do once, there was a really important component or something that you and your fellow astronaut had to fix. And it involved using a toothbrush to do the final repair.
Yeah, the long spacewalk, unfortunately, we had a little bit of a surprise. It was essentially a humongous circuit breaker panel, probably about 3 foot by 3 foot big, square rectangle box. And The bolt, which is pretty big for that size of a box, got a little bit stripped on the way in, unbeknownst to us. And so when we were taking it out, of course, there was more metal shavings. And again, the bolt is stripped. So we figured that out when we got the old box out and we were putting the new one in, and that's when we were having the problem. You know, it's just sort of like when you have the plug halfway in, though, you could have that electricity transfer across, which is not so good. So we had to undo it altogether, which then took up like the most of the 8-hour spacewalk. And then the second spacewalk after that, we got tools together. Well, you can't just go to the store, you know, and get tools. So you had to make your own tools to figure out how to clean this thing. My husband was giving me a hard time. He said, why don't you have, you know, bore cleaners or things like that up there? I'm like, well, we don't usually do that. So we had to get the toothbrush, put it essentially on an extension and a big ratchet, because we ended up doing this by hand ratcheting versus using the mechanical tools that we have to install the bolt so you could feel where the cross-setting was happening. So, yeah, we made a bunch of tools inside in between two spacewalks. We went outside and we were able to clean up the bolt, fix it all up, and get it installed. A little bit of, elbow grease and muscle versus using the tools, but that's okay.
Wow. And, okay, so just hearing you describe it, it's exhilarating. But then I also have to remind myself that you were in a spacesuit, right? So it's not like you had, the full dexterity of your hands, right? Because I've heard that whenever you even have to move your fingers inside the glove of a spacesuit, you're pushing against the material of the glove just to move your finger.
Oh, yeah. Your hands are a little bit tired when you get done with all of this. It feels like you're hitting your fingers, your tips of your fingers on like a hard board for about 6 hours because the gloves are just hard with the pressure differential, you know, with the vacuum outside and the, 4.5 PSI on the inside. So, yeah, your hands take a beating. And, you know, every now and then when you're working and you want to use two hands, you want to hold something in your teeth, well, you can't do that. You got your helmet there. So you have to be a little bit careful about where you're putting everything and make sure everything is tethered and nothing flies away. So there's a little bit of a constant mental process whenever you're using tools or working on equipment outside.
So what, from your experience, being in Earth orbit, what has that taught you about what you think the biggest challenges that future Mars astronauts are going to face? I mean, of course, there's the enormous technical challenge of putting humans on another planet. But what about, I guess one of the more interesting things coming out of the International Space Station is, did you feel psychological challenges being up there for such a long period of time?
Well, sure, because it is, you are away from home and you do miss your family and your friends. And of course, I missed my dog because I couldn't see him when I was up there. But that was not so bad because we had the ability to call home. We actually had the ability to have video conferences on the weekend. So I even got to see my dog on the weekend. But, you know, when you take, but we're close to Earth and we only have like a half a second of delay or so when we're talking. But when you start taking that trip and you're going to be going to Mars, you're going to have a long delay and you're not going to be able to have those instant conversations. You're going to need to know how to fix things without calling home to ask how to do it, you know. So there's going to be a lot of different challenges for that crew, and that crew needs to know that they'll be gone for a long time. I mean, I knew I would be gone for 6 months and maybe a little bit more. Like the folks right now, Peggy Whitson's up there, going to be up there for almost 9 months, and it's fun, it's great, but you need to go into this knowing that you might be gone for, you know, a year and a half or so, and you're going to have to sort of let things go. You're not going to be able to text to your friends and family like people are used to doing here. It's going to take a little while to get that communication back and forth.
Yeah. I'm going to fully disclose something. I went to space camp myself as a high school student, and it was like the best week of my life. That was back when I thought I was going to be an astronaut, but I didn't make the cut for a number of reasons.
Keep trying. We'll have more application processes coming up, so keep trying.
I think several knee injuries and, you know, impending decrepitude are going to make me not qualify for the future astronaut corps, but I love your motivation here. But I say that because I grew up at a time where, NASA was... it was sending regular missions up on the shuttle, and we were sort of at this heyday, this golden age of manned and womaned missions, I should say. to space, and it was being done through NASA. But now, you know, the discussion and the efforts for a manned Mars mission are going to also rely on the private sector as well. And sometimes I still feel an internal conflict about that, because it sort of it takes away the public-spirited dreaminess of saying, like, we as a nation are going to do this. When you bring in the private sector to these kind of efforts, I mean, am I being too cynical about that?
I would say maybe, yeah, because I think this is all a partnership. You know, it's there's been so much technology that's transpired over the last 20 or 30 years, and it's time to move that into the spacecraft. And who else can really better do that than, you know, the technology gurus out there? And that's the people who have been working in some of these companies. And we're really excited to see what their innovative ideas bring to the table when they create these spacecraft. You know, they're going to solve the problem for us for low Earth orbit, which means going to the International Space Station and delivering people. And we're going to watch how they're doing it. We're going to take some lessons learned. And NASA, that frees up NASA to work on exploration. The thing that we all want to do is get out of low Earth orbit and go farther, you know, so we can figure out how to really solve that problem to go to Mars. And that's what the Orion and the SLS Space Launch System program are all about. So, you know, we have a lot on our plate, but we're working hand in hand with these companies so we can leverage, information and technology off each other. I think it's really good. Mm. And, you know, my personal opinion, Sunny Williams, I think when we really leave the planet, you know, we ought to go as humans, not just people from one country or another. We are humans. We work together. This is our only planet as human beings that we know. So we all should have an interest in preserving it.
Yeah. What do you think about the idea of space tourism? I mean, that's being talked about more seriously with each passing day.
You know, I think it's great. You know, if we can, these companies can get out there and they can lower the price for folks to go to space, that's just going to enhance, you know, space travel, make it safer. You know, we've gone through this type of evolution with aircraft, and aircraft are pretty darn safe. You know, we joke around that one day, you know, we'll have a space station on the moon, and, you know, the tourists up there will be going, you know, where's my spacecraft to get me home? It's 10 minutes late, just like we do when we're standing in the airline line there waiting to board our aircraft. So I think, you know, it's a good thing. It's progress. It's evolution. You know, we're gonna make it all happen.
Yeah.
And I think this next generation of kids in high school and younger, we got to set the stage for them, and they're going to make it happen.
I could literally talk to you for an entire hour, but I'm afraid I'm running out of time. So I want to ask you just one last thing, though. What is the most amazing thing you've ever seen or witnessed up there in space?
There's so many things to say, but just something that folks can tag on to is probably the aurora. You know, watching the aurora from above is pretty spectacular. You know, we live up here in the north, and we go sometimes up to see our northern neighbors where we can see the aurora at night and stuff, and see it above you, and it's cool. But when you see it from above looking down below and see that energy hitting the earth, it's spectacular. And you gotta wonder at that point in time, you know, there's a lot of energy out there in the universe that we have no idea of how to even capture it or use it. And, we think of our problems here on Earth are a little slim compared to the real deal.
Wow. Well, Sunny Williams is an astronaut. She's been a commander of the International Space Station. She has spent 322 days in space. She's featured in the movie The Mars Generation, which is airing this Sunday at the Woods Hole Film Festival. She'll also be speaking at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday as part of a panel discussion on science and storytelling. We've got tons of information about that at radioboston.org. Sunny Williams, what a pleasure it has been to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Meghna, thank you very much. It's great to talk to you, too.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Housing supply continues to be not enough for the needs of the state of Massachusetts, and that's pushing the median price of a single-family home to new highs. It's now $410,000. Again, that's the median price of a single-family home in Massachusetts, and that's according to the Massachusetts Association of Realtors. Now, in the past, we thought the only way to really fix this problem is to build our way out of it. But is there more that we can do than just building more housing stock? So to explore this question, we're joined now by Barry Bluestone. He's founding director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy and a professor at Northeastern University. Barry Bluestone, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Okay, so more than $400,000 is a median price for homes.
Well, you know, when the Warren Group announced their first numbers, Tim Warren said that this is unprecedented and perhaps worrisome, were his terms. The fact is, the Massachusetts numbers pale in comparison with the Greater Boston numbers.
Right.
So if you looked at Greater Boston, the five counties of Essex, Middlesex, Norfolk, Suffolk, and Plymouth, prices were up to $451,000, which was a 28% increase since 2010. And then if you look at individual counties, Essex County up 6.5% in a single year. Middlesex County up 6%. Suffolk County, Boston, prices are up 10% in a single year. Now, there aren't that many people who get a 10% wage increase every year.
No.
And so the result is that housing has become so much more unaffordable. But the question is, for whom?
Right.
Developers know how to build housing for really rich people, and they're building lots of it. They also know how to build housing for some poor people because they get federal and state subsidies. What they've been unable to do is build housing for the vast middle for most people. And that's the nut we have to crack.
Right. Because I'm so glad you brought up this point, Barry, because there has been a boom in the luxury housing stock. And interestingly, some of those places aren't even being used as residences, rather investments.
They're bank vaults.
Yeah. Yeah. The very fancy, shiny new bank vault. So how can we then, to meet the needs of the great middle that are feeling the squeeze, how can we accelerate the building there?
Well, what we need is a coalition, and that coalition is coming together. We've been meeting with Suffolk Construction. We've been meeting with some of the biggest developers. We're meeting some of the best architects in the city. We've been talking with some of the universities. We've been talking with the city and state government officials. And we realize we're going to have to do a lot of things. We're going to have some zoning reforms, some building code reforms. There are new, brand new construction techniques which are more efficient, cheaper to build, and better. But most of those are in Europe. We have to bring them here. We have developers who are now saying, we've pretty much saturated the high end of the market. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to look at this big part of the market. How do we work with the building trades, the unionized building trades? We've got them involved in discussions. How do we deal with the city in terms of some of the NIMBYism? Where can we put this housing for workers? Where can we put housing for all those 109,000 graduate students who are living in the community or the tens of thousands of interns and residents in our hospitals? That new coalition, working with state and local government, I think is our first chance at breaking into that working class, millennial housing market. And I'm very excited that we've been having meetings almost every week to try and figure out what part of that puzzle we can fix over time so we can get it all together and talk about 20 to 30,000 new units of housing, some of it manufactured right here in Boston, giving jobs to young people in the community at the same time we solve their housing needs.
So Barry, I'm excited too to hear about this coalition, but give me a bigger sense as to what are people saying are the three most pressing challenges or things that would need to be fixed to unlock the potential to build all these houses.
Number one is new construction techniques that reduce the cost of construction by as much as 20 to 25%. Number two, we have to find a way to get investors into this market. And part of the way is working with the universities and teaching hospitals for their own graduate students and interns and residents so that those universities and teaching hospitals take master leases. Let's say we got my university and BU and BC and UMass Boston together, and they said, we'll work with the developer and we'll guarantee 100% of occupancy for 15 years. Mm. That makes the money flow. And then if we get the city working together to make sure we have zoning laws and building codes that allow us to build this new kind of housing, in some cases smaller units, in other cases using new techniques, then we've solved the problem.
Okay. But what about families? I mean, I'm a lot of what I'm hearing you say has to do with young millennials who you may or may not have families, but as they grow up, as they age, the kind of housing that they're going to need is different.
Right.
And we need to plan for that too.
Well, there's two
answers. People need it now.
Right. Well, there are two answers to that. One, even when I arrived in Boston back in the 1970s and I cruised down streets in Dorchester or JP or in the South End or anywhere else or in Cambridge, lots of triple-deckers and working-class families lived in them. Now, much of that housing stock, which is 40% of our stock in Boston, Somerville, and Cambridge, is taken over by young people. If we could get some of those young people into housing more appropriate for them,
we'd free it up
for
families.
It up, and then, using the same techniques, build housing for working families with 2 and 3 bedrooms.
Hmm. Well, Barry Bluestone is founding director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy. He's also a professor at Northeastern University, talking to us about the way forward in Massachusetts' continuing high cost of housing challenge. Barry, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Nice to be here again.
That's it for today and for this week. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.